wondrous. And it's only right that we should actually approach the weather forecast from Los Angeles with the traditional promo that, of course, we launched the show with yesterday and is well worth noting when we hear those dulcet words which say...
The truth is always out there, sometimes way out there, with the Midweek Drive team on Siren 107.3 FM.
Phil, indeed, as Gabriela Peralta has effectively had to go to Seville in Spain to cover a meeting for the Gibraltar Chronicle between the chief minister there and the president of Andalusia, and Shaylee McKenzie has just arrived and is setting herself up in the studio perfectly. It now falls to your good self to provide those awesome items of information which are critical to people's understanding of meteorology around the world, but especially with respect to Lincoln. It's your weather forecast from Los Angeles for Lincoln, England.
Well, I certainly hope that Gabriela Peralta, the girl from Gibraltar, will be able to let us know once and for all whether the rain in Spain does stay mainly on the plain. But in the meantime, the weather for Lincoln is looking to be actually quite a lovely day. Clear, sunny skies, a high of 8 degrees. Presently, it's 4 degrees Celsius. So a little bit cooler than those of us in Los Angeles are built for, but it sure does seem like a very attractive day there.
Absolutely. There we are. So positive stuff there. And you know, just as you make your first debut back with the program to actually deal with a whole variety of other aspects as well, we also welcome back Shaylee McKenzie. Shaylee, for your first program of Indeed 2018.
Hi there, guys.
And in addition to that, the first thing that Shaylee actually did this morning was put into my hand the delightful Truth Is Out There, Comedy, Consciousness, Conspiracy, the DVD, Dean Haglund, in a documentary by Phil Leonis, about to return to my shelf before once again it goes out. Spreading that word one viewer at a time, Phil.
Ah, well, excellent. I could actually use probably your feedback right now as I am hard at work editing part two of The Truth Is Out There and trying to make sense of what clips from the first one I need to use to illuminate a deepening exploration of certain themes in the movie. So that's what I've been doing all night when you called.
Shaylee, would you like to actually go straight into that feedback the director? It's like, you know, full 360-degree feedback. Off you go.
It was positively fascinating. For me, the paranormal stuff was more interesting. And it was very difficult to watch with a scientific mind who just constantly in my ear was like, that's not real because of this scientific law. He couldn't suspend his disbelief for 1 second and just enjoy it. But I'm looking forward to the second, definitely. You've got my attention.
It's why I find Bill Tiller, you know, one of the great scientific minds, so fascinating. And Edgar Mitchell, you know, founding the Institute of Noetic Sciences, because they seem to be men who managed to both master the world of physical science and also transcend it in their philosophical thought and their research into the powers and applications of consciousness. So I find some of the figures in the movie interesting, specifically because clearly they must have been able to overcome their own skeptical minds to get where they've got. You know, it's fascinating.
Definitely, yeah, 100% agree.
So there we are, positive stuff there. And now, Phil, you probably didn't catch the show yesterday because you were too busy re-editing and sorting through The Truth Is Out There too. Quite rightly so. But we were privileged this week to obviously share the news that Larry Nemechek, our mutual friend and colleague, although I don't, I'm not sure they've actually met Larry Nemechek, had sort of acknowledged the Mirror Universe scenario, Star Trek Discovery and so on. But he started a new podcast series, which I have to say last night, yes, partly because this week on Chilpack Hollywood, Dean decides to actually go medical with all sorts of knee-based stuff, etc. I'm thinking, nice. Oh, Dean, enough already, please. You know, it's just ease back on the medical. I mean, it's not, I was always tempted to actually call 911 at one stage, really. When you're going through that. But anyway, that's by the way. So this time, I have to say that the new 15-minute podcast series, in association with Rod Rodenberry, of course, Gene's offspring and so on, is a wonderful, awesome line for Star Trek. And they've got full access to the Rodenberry archives and files, etc., including, Phil, the official Star Trek Bible Guide, the third edition of which has circulated out to potential writers. We tested this out last night with our screenwriter Bill Coles up in Edinburgh. He didn't quite... He sort of partially succeeded after a little bit of help and assistance in this kind of question. Arthur Weingarten basically said... He would have reviewed it, and he knew Gene Roddenberry. He would have said it was insulting to writers to actually have to deal with this kind of thing. He was he was shocked and astounded that Gene was talking about in 1967, reaching out to the audience and so on. Cut a long story short, because we could go on all day about this, and Richard Fitzwilliams is up and running in a not-too-distant future. Phil, are you ready to put your director's hat on and writer's hat and actually take this... I won't say quiz, it's a scenario. It's not a no-win scenario. Ooh, don't worry about it. That's not Kobe Yashimiyu. We give you effectively a teaser, a descriptor teaser from a story outline which contains a major Star Trek format error. I can give you four choices afterwards, but your task, should you decide to accept it, is to identify what is the major Star Trek format error in this particular teaser. Are you ready for that, Phil Leonis?
I see. Okay, so I don't believe in the no-win scenario.
Yeah.
However, I do believe in really confusing instructions.
Okay.
So what you're going to tell me is going to give me a premise. You're going to give me a suggested scenario for a Star Trek episode.
Yes.
And I have to name a singular flaw that would prevent it from being a Gene Roddenberry approved episode of Star Trek.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's okay.
It. Right. Here we go. The scene is the bridge.
That would describe every episode of Discovery, but please keep going.
Oh, please remember, we're time traveling 31 years now. No, actually 51 years back to 1967. All right. So 51 years is where we're going back. 1967. The scene is the bridge of the USS United.
I don't understand how that math works. 1967 was 51 years ago, and yet I was born in 1968 and I'm only about to turn 30. But please continue.
The scene is the bridge of the USS United States Spaceship Enterprise. Captain Kirk is at his command position, his lovely but highly efficient female yeoman at his side. Suddenly and without provocation, our starship is attacked by an alien space vessel. We try to warn the alien vessel off, but it ignores us and begins loosening bolts of photon energy plasma at us. The alien vessel's attack begins to weaken our deflectors. Mr. Spock reports to Captain Kirk that the next enemy bolt will probably break through and destroy the Enterprise. At this moment, we look up to see the final energy plasma bolt heading for us. There may be only 4 or 5 seconds of life left. Kirk puts his arms about his lovely yeoman, comforting and embracing her as they wait for what seems certain death. Fade out, end teaser. Shaley, any thoughts? I mean, I know you're just teasing the sort of Trek thing, but any initial thoughts about that? No, silence from Shaley.
Yeah.
Phil, do you want the four choices? I mean, I offer this to Shaley as well.
So I have four choices of what the error is.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Because my only guess, I must admit that my only guess at this point was that Kirk sexually harassing a female crew member didn't come fast enough. So that's my only, but please give me my choices.
Choice number one, and Shaley, you might want to go this as well. Choice number one, inaccurate terminology. The Enterprise is more correctly an international vessel, the United Spaceship Enterprise, not the United States Spaceship Enterprise. Option two, scientifically incorrect. Energy plasma bolts could not be photon in nature. Option three, unbelievable. The captain would not hug a pretty yeoman on the bridge of his vessel. And our final option, a weak concept. This whole story opening reeks too much of space pirate or similar bad science fiction.
Oh, God.
Sorry. Shaley, any thoughts from yourself? Any options?
I know very little about science, but I kind of want to go for the terminology, the scientific terminology. But then again, I am not a scientific person.
Now, Phil, the time has come for you to make that decision. Which one?
Phil's going to get it
could
right.
Conceivably have actually got your career. Was it inaccurate terminology? Was it scientifically inaccurate? Was it concept weak? Was it unbelievable?
So, yes, you know, I can't guess B, the scientifically inaccurate, because I have no idea whether it was or not. And I can't believe that Gene Roddenberry would have known either. So I eliminate B. We know that it had better not be C, because then it's the height of hypocrisy about hugging the yeoman, because we've seen him do that. He did that in several episodes. So that leaves me with D. It's just a bad concept, though. You know, please, Spock's brain. So then I'm going to go with A, and I'm going to say it's faulty terminology, and it would be rejected for as simple a reason as calling it, as getting the designation USS incorrect.
Well, in the words of Nomad, faulty. Faulty. No, incorrect. It is actually unbelievable is the correct answer, simply because we've learned during a full season of making visual science fiction that believability of characters, their actions and reactions, is our greatest need and is the most important angle factor. Let's explore that briefly. And the Renard.
Wait a second. So what was unbelievable? What was unbelievable?
The unbelievable one was the captain would not hug a pretty yeoman on the bridge of his vessel.
But this was Captain Kirk, who did, in fact, in several episodes, hug pretty yeomans on the bridge. Yeah.
Let's just run through the Star Trek Bible that was here. And this is the same basic story situation and the rationale for why the answer is unbelievable. The time is today. We're in Vietnam waters aboard the Navy cruiser USS Detroit. By today, 1967, obviously. Just suddenly, an enemy gunboat heads for us. Our guns are unable to stop it. And we realize it's a suicide attack with an atomic warhead. Total destruction of our vessel and all aboard appears probably. Would Captain E.L. Henderson, presently commanding the USS Detroit, turn and hug a comely female officer who happens to be on the ship's bridge? Simple as that. Standard test that has led to Star Trek believability. It also suggests much of what has been wrong in film science fiction in the past. No, Captain Henderson or Kirk wouldn't hug a fellow officer if he's the kind of captain we hope would be in command of our noble naval vessel. Nor would Captain Kirk hug a female crewman in a moment of danger, not if he's to remain believable. Some might prefer Henderson, and so on and so forth. There we are.
Passing That's really interesting. Time.
That's the rationale. Remember, of course, DC Fontana, who's joining Larry Nemec check very shortly on the Trek files, also into that. But there we are. That's from the official Roddenberry files. And I'm sure, Phil, that your day, as you've headed into Thursday now, will be made just that little bit more believable as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know. Why would I think any Bible wouldn't be hypocritical? Anyway.
Well, I mean, the question that was actually put to the writers of the Bible as well, including Gene Roddenberry, by one of the writers, in fact, was, are you people on LSD? To which the response was, we tried, but we couldn't keep it lit. Anyway, so it goes. Richard Fitzwilliams is coming up in a matter of seconds, so he's got lots of things to talk about. But we need to ask, before we take a brief musical break to go to that, the world awaits the notion of what we wrapped up with Lily Holliman last week, just a long time ago. How did the premiere of Funny Story actually go? This tremendous comedy drama featuring not just Lily Holliman, but also the notion that Emily Bett Rickards, she's from Arrow. She's Felicity Snoke from Arrow. She's had the privilege of working with Lily Holliman. How did that go? Any news?
I wasn't there.
Right. That's what you call using social media to the fullness of time. Up next, Richard Fitzwilliams. Phil Dennis is still staying with us for a few minutes as well. And his OMD.
Be silent.
And whatever way you look at it, the future will not only just not be silent, it'll also be full of OMD believable material with Captain Kirk and so on. Interestingly enough, aficionados, surely, of the original series might well actually appreciate that sign and elements that we described there as filled in as doubt. In fact, actually, let's test Phil. Which episode was that kind of a real sort of descriptor of a certain part of an episode which became a classic in Star Trek history?
The description that you gave was so long ago, I can't remember it.
Balance of Terror. Anyway, talking about...
That's what I thought. Yeah, the bolts. That was very very descriptive. That's actually what I thought was the big plasma cloud that would approach.
Exactly. Limited range. Fortunately, Richard Fitzwilliams does not have limited range. And when we put Fitzwilliams and Leonis together, well, frankly, Shaylee, you and I can actually just leave the studio and have a three-course breakfast, basically, because it's that kind of level of dialogue and discourse.
Shall we actually?
No.
No. Unless you do, of course, and you could play Dunkirk and see it again.
Obviously, if I went 1958 Dunkirk, yes. I'm having a similar debate, actually, about 3:10 to humour, which my colleague, Professor Brian Winston, does not want us to actually sort of screen the original version because he thinks it's all clunky and prefers...
No!
Exactly.
The original is a wonderfully forward-thinking feminist work. No, we must discuss the original.
Thank you.
But the most recent one, I have to say, it wasn't too bad.
Well, exactly. My thoughts exactly. You know, but this is about how your colleague, who's an Emmy Award-winning colleague, he's been on this show, Professor Brian Winston, is saying, no, we shouldn't actually screen these. He said it's as staid and dull as The Searchers was last year.
That'll liven life up.
Yes. But anyway, you know, enough of that. Let's just talk about your CNN stuff, because... Just to explain to Shaylee and our listener, bless you, we have a situation where an annual prediction challenge takes place for the Academy Awards, okay?
Ooh.
Now, the only way to actually do this without actually employing Pricewaterhouse, because they need the work, obviously, after last year, is for both Richard and Phil to send me by email, and under seal delivery, obviously, their own predictions for around about five or six categories.
That's interesting.
So that's the line that will be happening.
Shape of Water did really well for the nominations.
Shape of Water indeed did extremely well with 30 nominations, but the shock for me, have to say this, I was at CNN International and watching the nominations and commenting as they came over, and there was no nomination for Martin McDonagh, director of Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and that means The Shape of Water is most emphatically favorite, and I expect that Phil will agree with me. Because, I mean, it's only four times, I think, since 1929 that a film hasn't had a nomination, Best Picture hasn't had a nomination in the Best Director category.
Although, you know what always gets overlooked, Richard, is that there is far more correlation between the Best Editing category and Best Picture, where only once in history has a Best Picture winner not been nominated for editing.
Very interesting, because I think the technical categories do tend to not to be ignored so much. I mean, there's been a lot with Netflix breaking through with the Rachel Morrison, the first woman cinematographer.
Yes,
had a certain
yes,
amount of
the
it,
first but... time ever. Sorry.
Yes,
first
time ever.
I was just celebrating. We were celebrating that today. We had the second woman ever nominated for Best Director.
Greta had to get that, I think, don't you? Because the Globes, as you know, was another all-male affair.
Well, it certainly was well-deserved, and these are the biggest reasons for excitement for me, because I must say, I look at the nine films nominated for Best Picture, And after hearing so much about how it wasn't a good year for cinema, I didn't feel that way for most of the year. I thought there were many, many interesting films, but I look at the quality of the nine nominated for Best Picture and I say, maybe those people who said it was a weak year have something, because there isn't a level of greatness in this batch of nominees that I think past years have possessed.
I would say there was a level of excellence. The word greatness puts it to a level that I must admit, for me, I have to rattle on about Dunkirk, but Dunkirk is not going to win. And I mean, the fact that it was showing the action on land, sea and air and the famous 1940 evacuation at different time zones, the fact that I was fascinated by it, the fact that critics absolutely adored it, the fact that it made a fortune at the box office, all of this becomes, alas, an irrelevance because it is not an American story. And it perhaps the lack of characters that individuals felt they could identify with, perhaps the very structure of it. I started talking about Dunkirk to not just Alex, to others, and my enthusiasm wasn't replicated. And let's face it, it's simply not going to do it, or unless there's some absolutely weird last-minute change in the Academy's alternative vote system, which is so complicated that I couldn't help but I've had to read several times how they do it. But it seems to me it's going to be almost certainly The Shape of Water. Get Out has got a chance. Three Billboards, do you believe, because I think it's a remarkable film, I was fascinated by it. I mean, whether you regard it mainly as a black comedy, and I have to say in the second viewing, I went as for a black comedy, in which case it should, of course, have been up for Best Comedy or Musical at the Globes, in which it was not. What is your final prediction for Best Picture? Because I have to go with The Shape of Water, because it looks to me as if that is going to be the way it will go. But and it's a marvelous movie. I was fascinated by it. But it's a fantasy movie. It's with sort of sci-fi elements set in the 1960s. Fantasy movies do not normally do well, as well you know, at the Oscars. But here's my question too. Are we looking at a period with 1,500 new members, I think it's 7,258 voters now, where looking for at the past and for the predictions we've always enjoyed talking about what happened before, that this doesn't really apply now, that we're looking for a new, completely new Academy, ideas that are new and views that are new. So what is your take on Best Picture? I have to predict Shape of Water on the evidence that I can see. And secondly, do you think that we're entering a new diverse zone, which does seem, fortunately, eventually to be sort of starting to come?
Well, there's so many topics there to unpack, Richard. First, let me say one thing about Dunkirk. I wish that, speaking of great editors, that a great editor would take Dunkirk, Darkest Hours, and Their Finest, and cut them together, because I think the three of those movies would make one extraordinary film if edited together. When it comes to Martin McDonagh and Three Billboards, their chances were greatly hurt this past week when the New York Times just went to war against the movie.
The script.
In terms of the complicated voting procedure of the Academy Awards, what would you expect here in America? We hold elections, Richard, where someone can win by 3 million votes and still lose. So what would you expect from our motion picture awards? But in terms of Shape of Water, I'll let you in on a little, as we would call it, a little inside baseball tip for you. The campaigning for this movie actually began years ago, quite effectively for the Academy, through a Los Angeles County Museum of Art exhibit of the work and artwork and inspiration and library and props of Guillermo del Toro. There was a enormously popular exhibit dedicated to Guillermo del Toro and his art, and one massive section of this exhibit was all about the prep work for The Shape of Water.
And every single Academy voter went through this exhibit again and again and again. So this has been on their radar for so long that it's really, it's like a political election now, where these campaigns begin even before the movie gets made. And it was a very smart campaign run by this particular film. But I do think that the demographic makeup of the Academy is changing, though the most important demographic element is not changing. And that is that the vast majority of the voting members of the Academy are actors. And so you are going to see films that have often really spectacular ensemble acting that are often your Best Picture winner. And I think that's true of Shape of Water.
And, of course, that will finally destroy Dunkirk, I fear. But what about The Post? I was very interested in this because The Post was, I thought, so well made. It had Streep and Hanks. Hanks didn't pick up a nomination. Always interesting, this. And also, any chance that Get Out could suddenly sneak under the radar, and I was very interested. I didn't know about the Shape of Water exhibition. And this sort of campaigning, remembering what it did in the famous Saving Private Ryan versus Shakespeare in Love, you know, the extraordinary way that campaign, we do not wish to go into the details of the person who orchestrated it, but it was successful. And when one looks, and I must say one experience I've had this year, because I've seen several screeners, and now I've had the opportunity to see the films like Lady Bird and on the large screen, really makes such a difference when you can, say, see The Post and you can hear every word and you're not just relying on seeing it on a small screen. That was what finally did for Saving Private Ryan, I fear, in that famous contest then. I'm fascinated by what you say about The Shape of Water, because it seems to be a brilliantly planned campaign, and of course you couldn't predict what it would be up against at that time. But agreeing that there is no, minus Dunkirk, my own view, a greatness, we have Call Me By Your Name, which I would absolutely love to win. I fear it's obvious in competition of the sort it's not going to. I was very pleased to see Darkest Hour and also Phantom Thread made the cut for Best Picture, because I didn't think they would, according to reports again, and some of them were inaccurate. But it does seem to me Gary Oldman's got it for Best Actor without any question, and the gloriously idiosyncratic Churchill. I mean, it's fantastic. I'd love to have seen Timothée Chalamet have a chance, and Daniel Day-Lewis, well, he can't win every time. Very good, though a movie of slightly mixed merit, in my view. Best actress has to be Frances McDormand. There seems little doubt about it. I can't see Sally Hawkins stealing it from her, but Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie, I mean, wonderful performances there. Meryl Streep, too, but again, already multiple winner. Sam Rockwell does seem to be Best Supporting Actor, but you were mentioning the New York Times. Could you tell us a bit about this? I don't know of the article, but I presume it deals with the some of the dialogue in Three Billboards, which has been damaging.
No, it was more placing it in a historic context of a film that emerges initially without much buzz behind it for awards or for audience, but that gets championed as kind of the film of the time. And it put this film in a lineage with last year's La La Land, with Crash. And it says it's a film that, you know, captures a certain spirit, a certain feeling right now that a year from now everyone will be embarrassed by.
That is very harsh.
It was very harsh. It was very, very harsh. The Culture article about it, and I think that it does affect the voting, because I do think the Academy is quite nervous about repeating embarrassing Best Picture mistakes of the past. They want these choices to last certainly for a year, but also hopefully to go down in history well. So I do think they're prone to that kind of column swaying their voting. I will say that to me the biggest I like how you pointed out that, you know, some people are deserving, but they can't win every year. I think Daniel Day-Lewis, though, this is his last role. So there may be people who will vote for him because they want to send him off with another win that is a record-setting win, especially if they believe, as so many do, that he's the greatest actor of all time. I think it's a shame that Meryl Streep can't win because she's won and been nominated so many times before, because I actually think this might be her best work.
Wonderful. I totally agree. Just let me just say that is such a beautifully nuanced role. Someone who's self-effacing, actually rather modest, taking on a job, and the way she played it, I thought that was exquisite. I really did. I not to take away from the fact Margot Robbie did a wonderful job in Tanya and Sotcha and in Lady Bird, or fair enough, Frances McDormand does seem to have it, but I loved Meryl Streep in The Post, and I think it would have been a crime had she not been nominated. The one performance that I would like to have seen in a very, very strong category, Best Actress, and was Annette Bening in Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool, because a role close to home, I fear, for me, but I was deeply moved.
You've been listening to Richard and Phil talking movies and Academy Awards here on Siren Radio, and they'll be back with another epic scenario in the very near future. Gentlemen, it's been fantastic just sharing some wonderful thoughts there, but as ever, Phil needs to get some sleep in Los Angeles. Richard has all sorts of things to do to CNN. Richard, I'll rephrase
we
that.
Haven't managed to
I know. Now, I'm going to ask Phil, you've got two choices for what Richard can have for his shortened film review today. We're offering you, and this is your choice, Phil, so you take full responsibility on this. You managed to cope with the believability test from Star Trek earlier, so let's see where you go. The choices are Last Flag Flying or Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle. Where do you want to send Richard for dinners?
I have actually seen Last Flag Flying, so I'm I would ordinarily want to hear Richard's take on that, but I can't resist. It just sounds too delicious, the idea of Richard Fitzwilliam reviewing a film that stars The Rock. That's what I want to hear.
Go, Richard.
Well, I'll have to. No choice then. Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. And a movie that I have to say I approach with a good deal of trepidation. And what do I find? I find that I rather enjoy it. And I see others have, and the box office is $800 million, and director Jake Kasdan has had a lot of fun with us. A remake when in 1996 a teenager receives a Jumanji board game and is transported into it, and then 20 years later four students at a high school placed in detention discover while they're clearing out the school's basement that this action-adventure video is there's Jumanji, and when you press start, all sorts of weird and wonderful things happen. You're sucked into the game in the jungle, and you become you have an avatar. So a student can become Dr. Smolder Bravestone, Dwayne Johnson doing his stuff. I have to say, I last saw him in Baywatch, a movie that I will not say was the greatest of the last year, but here we have him just having his fun and strutting his stuff, and young Fridge becomes becomes a shark geologist, Mouse, played by Kevin Hart, Martha becomes a gorgeous commando, martial art expert Ruby, played by Karen Gillan, and Bethany and a beast cartographer Professor Oberon, played by Jack Black, and that task on this extraordinary in this extraordinary jungle to prevent a big game hunter, Basil Rampelt, played by Bonnie Cannavale, from a obtaining the Jaguar's Eye, which is a jewel where he can control the animals in Jumanji. And, of course, they discover Alex, whose avatar is a pilot, played by Nick Jonas. He's already there, and he helps to save them, and then they have to distract guards. They have to replace the stone, and do they return to normality? And how does this movie amuse and entertain? The answer is it amuses and entertains rather a good deal, like Kong Skull Island. I found a lot to be very, very amused.
Richard, I mean, you're already, Phil actually led with this earlier. Surely, forget Dunkirk, Darkest Hour, and so on. What we really need is that editorial connection between Kong, Skull Island, Baywatch, and Jumanji for the ultimate Academy Award fest of scenarios.
And there it is. You've said it. Geez. Something lighthearted, imaginative. It was sending itself up all the time. It wasn't serious for a second, and a lot of people were having fun with it. I saw it in the cinema, not a preview, which I think was just as well, and I had quite a lot of fun with it. It did go on a bit occasionally, but no, this is an amusing movie, and The Rock, oh yes, he was in good form. Yeah. They were all on pretty good form. You're not looking for subtlety, you're looking for something that will entertain the family, and I found a lot of fun. I can't go on, obviously, to Richard Linklater, but I mean, the point is, I worship him. Here, I found that I'm perfectly prepared to worship the jaguar's eye.
Yeah, nice. So, Phil...
That was fantastic. That was a fantastic conclusion.
Exactly. The joy is there, and clearly, Phil, you've now got the ultimate movie for Fuzz Aldrin's recuperation. Just get hold of a copy of Jumanji, and Welcome to the Jungle, and Fuzz will just be in seventh heaven. Fantastic. So, Shaley, would you like to put those last two questions to Richard, and then I'll do reciprocate with Phil, because he's going to have to go. We've got Ian Lennox sort of waiting up and so on. So over to you, please, Shaley.
Indeed. It's been an interesting morning. Richard, have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today?
I can only say that I have enjoyed it enormously, and Bill, so good to chat. It's been pleasure unalloyed.
And can we rely on you for next week?
Happy 2018 to you, Richard.
And a happy 2018. Oh. I'm just looking forward to meeting up in March when you're over. So
we have actually gone through 2018. We're now in 2019, actually. But never mind. That's okay.
Playing with time. Yes. Well, why not, after all?
So I take it he'll be back with us next week, will Richard?
I look forward very, very much to it. So enjoyed it, and of course on the 4th of March we will see and hear a great deal more. And also, we've got to mention this because it didn't come up. I mean, we haven't had time to deal with it, but I mean, with the Globes wearing black and with those badges, and then with the SAGs and all female presenters, what will the Oscars do with the hashtag Me Too and also Time's Up campaigns? Wow. And that will be absolutely fascinating.
It will indeed, almost as fascinating as really the wedding of the year, of course, Princess Eugenie. But that's another line entirely.
Well.
don't go there, Richard, please. You know, just bold it out there for due consideration. Phil Leonis, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic connection with us this morning, in which we've moved from Star Trek through to Jumanji, which I don't think you were expecting probably when you actually started this off at a few minutes to midnight in Los Angeles?
No one ever expects Jumanji. That's one of its secret weapons, surprise.
Exactly.
I've had a great time.
So are you back next Wednesday for your first official Wednesday of the midweek drive? Or I mean, because Lily did a fantastic job last night, of course, with the update on Fuzz Aldrin and so on. And, of course, Funny House, an awesome movie, which is going to be outrageously wonderful. Will you be back with us then? Will you be back with us next Thursday? When can we next connect with you?
Funny story, you mean, not Funny House.
Thank you.
I would love to be back next Wednesday, but I have a feeling that a board meeting that both Lily and I will be in will go long. That's what I think will happen. So it might be next, it might be the morning edition.
There we are. But we'll find out in the fullness of time. And of course, that's what happens with the wonderful joys of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club when you are the chair of the board as well. It's all great stuff. Richard, we salute you once again. This is Noah and the Whale, Heart of Nowhere.
Outside. about to do. You find a way. You let your anger and your sadness break. Inside the nighttime with a charcoal grin, the falls in diamonds on her pallid skin. And when she turns around, he's laid out on the ground. And now you're standing with your finger on the post, and then an open door, two footsteps on the floor. And now you're standing with your finger on the post. If I don't.
So, Shady, I'm not sure if you're one for statistics, facts and details, but if you're actually looking at, for instance, 18-0 as a scoreline, you might still think, oh, that's interesting, as in 18 corners to 0 corners, as in, let's see, 9 shots on target to 4 shots on target, as in 21 shots on goal to 6 shots on goal, and 81% of the possession as opposed to 19% of the possession. You think?
Wait, is this in one game?
This is one game.
18 goals in one game?
No, 18 corners. 18 corners, three goals, actually. Well, actually, 4 goals, technically, but 81% possession. It was nice, actually, because it actually demonstrates to Rafa Benitez what he could have had. Sorry, Ian, I couldn't really... I mean,
you're riling him up.
I could tell he's...
You're poking the bar.
I could almost hear the sound of the irritated microwave pinging in the background there as he's sort of saying, look, you know, please. You know, but wasn't Sane's delivery to Sergio superb for the third goal, Ian?
It just shows what money can do, doesn't it?
You've got all Mike Ashley's millions. What more do you want?
Well, no, we haven't. He's got all his millions.
Look at it from the positive side. It's the cup that cheers, and your boys are in London, specifically at Stamford Bridge, this coming Sunday, the 28th of January, 13:30 hours.
Everything... feeds in insignificance to the league, actually, for us.
All
we've got to do is survive the league and then get some television money and hopefully build from there and keep Benitez.
All right.
That's our ambition, I imagine.
Well, in comparison...
Bleak, isn't it?
In comparison to Hartlepool, you're in the promised land, you see. There we are, so we'll bear that
what
in
a
mind.
Shame, though, isn't it?
Well,
teams aren't like, historic teams aren't like going down.
Exactly.
Threatened.
Meanwhile, I did sort of say I wasn't going to tease Ian, but 4-1 on aggregate isn't bad, really. But still, never mind. It's all good. And it's nice to see that Sergio Aguero is so much in love with the Newcastle sort of area that he regularly scores against you, which is nice. And you did get a goal, Ian, so well done. You know, well done for actually getting that, and that obviously helped improve your goal difference. So, you know.
Well, you may laugh, but we come out to from two games with minus three, and our relegation rivals, I don't think any of them will do that.
Yeah.
And that may well be crucial at the end of the season.
Exactly, as Alan Shearer would indeed say. But we're moving on to bare knuckle. Why? Because, quite frankly, it's a critical sort of line to actually work through on that basis. Just had news, actually, with respect to Eva McDonald. She's singing somewhere at 10 o'clock this morning, so she couldn't get to her siren in time, but she's singing somewhere at 10 o'clock. Didn't say where, though.
I feel like you should question this.
We should actually sort of say, well, I might sort of treat it for you. Where is she singing?
Yeah.
Could be in the bath, could be in the shower. could be public. Bare knuckle, yes. I mean, the official review of Bare Knuckle has now been postponed slightly because one of our presenters for the Book of the Month podcast that we put together has had to sort of delay slightly. But I now see, Ian, what you meant about the typos and errata. And so, I mean, Shaylee's obviously bought her copy. Whereabouts, what have you reached in Bare Knuckle as yet?
I'm about halfway through, but yeah. I did notice sort of in the first part of it there were... a couple of words where the letters were like switched around almost.
Yes, there was also a bad spelling error actually.
And some missing words as well. Now I'm thinking to myself, this is not what we expect from Ian Lennox. This is not a sort of line from there.
I was actually wondering, like, how do you actually type it in, or how do you go?
I mean, I use a computer to type the original novel. But what what happened was that for 6 months. It sounds strange, but I've been ill. I've had a virus. And I've been obviously... I didn't realise
it's been a computer virus, Ian. It's been a computer virus. You've had a computer virus.
No.
That's it.
And anyway, when I eventually... I became very ill over Christmas. I'd lost about 20 pounds over... I didn't eat for about 5 weeks.
Oh, wow.
But when I came to revise it, I tried to edit it myself. I was just too ill really to do it, and also I'm the last person in the world to do that when you've written a book because you're sick to death of it.
You never want to have the author do their own proofreading.
I've got is friends to read 4 or 5 chapters each. I'm there.
Ex-friends
readers
now,
and hopefully within about 2 weeks. I'll just put it back onto Kindle as a revised version, which will be...
But you see, that's the beauty of that, you see. You've got revised version and original version with errata. So you can actually get much more audience participation. You can actually spot the sort of science of that.
It's more niche.
Oh, no.
I mean, I've reached the stage where he's been to Manchester, our hero Harry. He's come back from Manchester. He's sorting out things. He's involved with a kind of London-based system. Certainly you're packing all manner of marvellous things in there, Ian, and it is actually getting better.
I like him as a character. He's a very... likeable character.
Yes, he is, isn't he? Despite being a very, obviously living in a violent world. He's,
Well, never mind. It's interesting, though, because Ian Lennox clearly having the same kind of illness that Phil Leonis was down with, that Fuzz Aldrin clearly has been down with. But
Fuzz all right?
The common theme, of course, has been quite simply that all have survived and thrived because they are midweek drive-outs. Death is not an option. At least until we actually say, I'm sorry, Ian, we're not going to ask you these last two questions. End of. That's the time to worry. You know, if we sort of just go away and they say, they haven't asked you the last two questions.
No point in asking them those.
It's a different line. But you do have two wonderful cats, of course. That's Ollie and Obo. If you went to the stage of actually having to because obviously I think, is it Ollie or Obo who's got visually impaired?
Ollie's become visually impaired, yes. He's, having said that, it seems to... I'm praying that it's arrested and he's only partially sighted. He's just jumped on a big table here.
Oh, well, there we are.
To get out of the house, he actually jumps... Well, he goes in through the cat flap, jumps 3'6" on the window ledge, jumps 3 feet on the dividing wall, does a reverse on next door neighbours and goes through the gate. He must have sight.
He can't be that blind,
No.
And do you not give him a house key then? Is he not allowed?
He's not that clever.
he's a live-in sharing partner and he has to do all of that just to actually get into the house, for Lord's sake.
He's just come on the table, actually, and he's screaming for his breakfast.
my point being, presumably in terms of vet fees and other aspects, I mean, the thing that has really impressed me about how Phil and Lily have actually put the GoFundMe together campaign for Fuzz Aldrin, you look at the high side of a couple of $100,000 for that, £100,000.
That really surprised me, because Well, it's almost as much as being a human and being ill.
Yeah.
Oh, it's more expensive. Yeah. I mean, you've got natural health for humans.
So do you have any insurance for Ollie and Oba?
Yes, I pay £26 a month for the two of them. Yeah.
For which, obviously, they're both very grateful, because, quite simply, I think the costs would have been very prohibitive. I mean, obviously, we've had support, and Phil's had lots of support, as we heard, from, you know, teams across the world, etc. But it's been, obviously, difficult to raise that. And apparently, in the States, if you don't pay up front, you don't get the treatment. So until you actually pay, no treatment.
So if people can't pay, it could mean the death of a beloved pet.
That's it. End of.
That's horrendous.
Well, this is a big...
It's a moot point I was going to raise with Phil again this morning. We probably will at future times, but in terms
disgusting.
Of what ideology...
The American health system based on the principle of making money.
Yeah. Definitely.
It certainly is. I mean, and to a lesser extent, Canada. If you go on holiday abroad to either America or Canada, you watch your premiums, your insurance premiums go up. And it's purely because if you have to go to hospital in either of those countries, it'll cost you a fortune.
Or else you die.
Yeah.
It's brutal and harsh, and again something which maybe in an era where, as a human species, we're supposed to effectively have so many good things happening, you know, the notion of not having affordable healthcare for all universally needs to be addressed. President Trump, sorry,
I'm currently enjoying the sort of ban that's going to be coming on single-use plastic, which is going to be interesting to see how that plays out in the next couple of years.
No more.
Well, I think we should have a referendum and stuff on.
Yes, we don't have enough of
things on whether we are willing to pay more money for the health service.
Yeah, exactly. We need because
anybody who votes no to that is an absolute fool.
Yeah. As indeed Clement Attlee would have said when he set the thing up back in 1946.
It's pretty obvious, and we're living longer, and we're obviously the problems of old people in the community and that sort of thing, and the cost of the NHS is escalated,
and we haven't put the
money in to compensate that. And I know everyone's saying we'll pay more money for the NHS than ever before. Of course we are, but the point is, it's still not enough, because we're living till 80 now, until people dying in their 60s.
Well, not everybody's living till they're 80, of course, Ian.
Well, yeah, I think the average age is around about 80.
There's very little.
Please, Ian. I mean, in your case, it's 126. I've already seen the books.
Don't tempt fate. It didn't feel like it about a month ago, did it?
Oh, yeah, but, you know, you kept going, you know, even though you were grumpy, you still did the weekly Thursday slots. That's the important thing. You know, it's always good. Well, there we are. Ian Lennox goes political. Who'd have thought it, eh? It's great stuff as ever to see the line put together. Of course, there are a whole heap of other good Ian Lennox novels that are actually out there if you want to work through that. And I'm going to talk about the shared universe that one day, I'm sure, you'll connect the brothers with Gentlemen and Players, with The Net, with The 60s Man, with, of course, Bare Knuckle, in some kind of wonderful, glorious...
That could be interesting.
...almanac-type mashup, really, in which all the characters will emerge and work together. Because there's no reason. He's never actually sort of said that they take place in different universes. They could all be in the same world. All that.
Different time zones,
but when has that stopped a good novelist?
I mean, a Doctor Who from my booth.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a way forward. A Geordie Doctor Who, now that would get the Who fans talking. Hiya, pet, where's the Dalek over here?
You'll have to keep practicing that,
Alex. Having said that...
People will laugh at you, not with you.
I have recorded some readings for the Book of the Month of Bare Knuckle. They're in the system, they're in the can, and I have actually channeled my inner Geordie to actually sort of work through that. So,
could be interesting to hear.
Don't do it just for anybody, but it is there. We'll put it
It'll
out.
Probably go down all right in Lincoln.
Don't know how to take that, Ian. It could have been a borderline insult. So,
yeah. Oh, Harry, how am I here?
Very useful. In fact, I saw one of our workers actually respond to that, and he actually had his hammer. He was going to actually hoist that hammer over here.
How would you mind showing your hammer over here?
There is a loudspeaker that's going out so they can hear everything we're saying. I just wanted to point that through.
Hi, guys.
When I was a young reporter, we used to start taking in graduates, and there's a chap came up from Oxford, and he's a very, very bright lad, obviously, but... quite arrogant. So the news editor sent him up to the West End of Newcastle, where the real Newcastle people speak, real Newcastle. And he came back ashen faced and said, "I didn't understand a word he said."
It's like a whole new experience of life. In
it's another language, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It is. It's a patois, I suppose. It's, yeah.
Good word. Good
when
word.
I was, do you think you've I lived seen down the south of France for a while.
We're just commenting on our wonderful latest occupying workforce here, who seems to be actually spraying the whole window area with a sort of ceiling.
Oh, I see. You're getting taken over by the cleaners, right?
Oh, no. More than that. Anyway, you're listening to Siren Radio, where the time is almost 2.5 minutes to 9 o'clock, which means it's almost time for the news, which means it is time, Shaylee, for you to ask Ian Lennox those last two questions, please.
Ian, have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today?
Yes, so much I forgot my breakfast in the oven.
Oh no! Yeah. What are you having?
Ham and eggs, basically.
Nice, very Dr. Seuss.
Yes. Yeah.
And can we rely on you for next week?
Yes, I'll cook my breakfast a little earlier next week.
There we are.
Good.
I suppose Alice will ring out of devilment a bit earlier, but anyway.
Oh, yeah, I'm thinking maybe 3 a.m. You know. anyway. So it goes.
Yeah. You don't want to make this work. You just want to make this worse. Want me to listen to you, but you don't ever hear my words. You don't want to know my hurt yet. Let me guess. You want an apology, probably. How can we keep going at a rate like this? We can't. So I guess I'm gonna have to leave. Please don't come after me. I just want to be alone right now. I don't really want to think at all. Go ahead, just drink it all. Both know you're gonna call tomorrow. Like nothing's wrong. Ain't that what you always do? I feel like every time I talk to you, you're in an awful mood. What else can I offer you? There's nothing left right now. I give it all to you.
On the edge right now. I wish that I could say I'm proud. I'm sorry that I let you down. Let you down. All these voices in my head.